Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Ross Clare podcast. Today, our special presenter, Phil Murphy, journalist, former editor of the hugely popular Ireland's Own magazine and former sports editor of the People newspaper group, horse racing pundit and newspaper columnist, will interview his friend, Liam Griffin, a man who needs no introduction in the county of Wexford, or indeed anywhere on this island of ours. Today, Phil delves into the life and the psyche of the man who became the legend.
Hello, this is Phil Murphy here. I'm going to be talking today to Liam Griffin, Wexford hurling guru, businessman and family man. And I thought we'd start off, Liam, by just having a quick run through your family background, if that's okay with you.
No problem, Phil.
So perhaps you just fill me in on your own mum and dad.
Yeah, my mum was from North Wexford up near Killena, and she was from farming stock. They had a good-sized farm, actually, at that time. It was 100 acres or thereabouts. So she was, obviously, her granny, her mother was from Boulevogue, and her grandfather, or her father from Boulevogue. But when my father came to from Clare, and first station actually was in Clonevin, which is not too far from Ballygarrett. Pretty rural area. Yeah. And they met my mother and father. My mother's father died tragically from pneumonia, from being out too much ploughing in wet weather and all sorts. And he died in his 40s. And my granny was left a widow. I'd say she was in the end of her 30s and was in black from there till the day she died. Mm-hmm. And she was a lovely woman, a great, great, great woman. But how we became to the hotel business was because they had a fine farmhouse, and the economic war had been on, and all of the troubles of the First World War and various things, and the economic war came. And they were really under pressure, so they started a farm guest house. So that's what started us into the hotel business in the end. Right. And kids are fourth generation now in the business. So that's what started. But they were transferred to Ross Lair when my mother and father got married, because you couldn't be within 30 miles of your own, of your own home or your own relations. That was that rule then. It's not now.
Yeah.
So he was transferred to Ross Lair, and we got to the Coast Guard station here in Ross Lair. And my mother was back into guest house business and knitting businesses and all sorts. She was a real entrepreneur. So so we settled in, we started, and we were raised in Ross Lair.
Right. Where were you actually born?
I was born in my mother's home place, which would have been common at the time, in the Burnham House, Killena Gorry, that's where I was born. And then we were reared in Ross Lair. And we had an idyllic life as kids, absolutely idyllic, wouldn't change anything of it.
Right. And of course, your mother then, she's from very perilously close to Buffers Alley country up there.
She is, and she had a bit of the cut of Buffers Alley about her as well. She was a very intelligent lady, very well educated, but a fantastic Wexford person, very, very proud of Wexford. And of her relations, she had a major thing with relations. We had relations everywhere. Actually, people in Wexford, I got more people saying, thinking I'm from somewhere else, or I was from Clare, because I played for Clare. But I come from a long line of Wexford people, and I'm proud of that myself. Like George O'Connor's father would be my mother's first cousin. So they all started out. I think they might have been in the parish of Ferns, actually, on the edge of Boulevogue. I'm not quite certain exactly if that's what it is, but I know they went to school, and the church was Boulevogue before that.
So isn't it ironic then that you had a connection right up to 1996 with the O'Connor clan, with George? John, I think, and you're related, are you, to Tony Dorn?
Yeah, related to Tony Dorn as well, and Pat Nolan and John Nolan, who played for Wexford. They were
the
1960s, they were huge for me because I was only a kid, and they were playing the Ireland final, and Pat Nolan was like, we used to go up there on a Sunday and I'd drag himself and John out to play hurling with me.
Right.
But they were two gentlemen and two great hurlers.
They were. Well, Pat was an outstanding goalkeeper for 20 years for Wexford.
Himself and Damien Fitz were you know, were two amazing goalkeepers that we produced.
And John had his moment at Laurie in the 1960 All-Ireland when he had Jimmy Doyle scoreless.
Exactly.
Right.
That's the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
That was his first ever championship game for Wexford, the All-Ireland final.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that team that brought back Tim Flood too for the Leinster final of that year.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing, like, that they didn't have any, they didn't have anything whatsoever, hiccups in picking up people or any.
Yeah.
They were never reticent about picking up at that stage. You wouldn't do that today.
Yeah. No, or leave fellas off to make room for somebody else. And exactly. That sort of stuff, yeah. And of course, interesting about Paddy O'Connor, George's father.
Yeah.
He was on the Wexford team that made the breakthrough at junior level in 1939.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was a young lad playing with them called Nicky Record.
And the two were in the middle of the field.
Yeah. So it's a long story.
No, it's a long story. It's a long history. Yeah.
And funnily enough, to me, one of the most iconic images from 96 was George dropping to his knees in Croke Park just after the final whistle.
The only person...
And offering thanks. Yeah.
The only person I ever remember or knew of doing that was Ronnie Delaney after the Olympic final in 1956.
Yeah.
And I was up at night time with my dad listening to that race.
Yeah, it was actually about 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I was listening to that race and boxing as well. I used to watch the heavyweight fights and we listened to it at night.
Yeah, 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning.
But I remember Ronnie Delaney well.
Yeah.
And I started us up in the Coast Guard station.
And he blessed himself.
Yeah, blessed himself. Mm. Like us up in the Coast Guard station. My brother Pat was a professional coach in England eventually.
Mm.
We had Olympic games non-stop up there in the Coast Guard station.
Yeah, right.
We used to run around here actually, down all around this side of the village.
Yeah.
I'd get a nod at 8 years of age up on the top of the bridge up near the Coast Guard station. And he'd blow a whistle and we all ran like hell all the way around. You know, hard to believe looking back.
But... actually, I met Mrs. O'Connor in the Stillorgan Park after the 1996 final.
Well, did you? Yeah.
Just immediately after the match.
Yeah.
And I don't think there could have been a prouder woman in the whole of Ireland.
No,
George
because...
and John played. Yeah.
That my memory of Paddy O'Connor and Mrs. O'Connor was all the matches, she had this kind of a brown coat, I can seriously still, and they used to go to all the matches, and Wexford never won a thing. George didn't win a single medal.
No,
but I think he
for nearly 20 years at various levels for Wexford.
Yeah, and he might have won an Oireachtas medal in the very first game he ever played. I'm not quite sure, ask him again, but he won no medal, not even a Welsh Cup medal from all of that time, you know, which is amazing, wasn't it, for a man that long?
Well, I thought it was really fitting that he should have finished centre stage in Croke Park and winning in All-Ireland after all that time.
The great things from Tom Williams' poem is his first chance, his last chance on Hurling's Green Bower.
Yeah.
And that's what it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
How many other members were in your family, Liam? Your brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had two brothers, Pat and Val.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, we had a great relationship and, you know, it was just... It was fantastic to grow up in a terrace of houses, all guards and all guards' children.
Right.
And I was one of the youngest of all those.
Mm.
And it was, you know, everything was kind of contagious. If there was running, it was contagious, no matter what it was.
Mm.
But sport was really contagious. But like the old films you'd see of people in listening to radios, that's one of my longest memories with the big matches. I remember the 56 Leinster football final better than nearly anyone because there was a man from Kildare in the same room as us at the time.
We were beaten by a point.
And we went out to play on the lawn afterwards, and this man, Tom Clinch, he was a great character. He was married to Paddy O'Connor's sister, Marty. But anyway, he came out to play on the green at Coast Guard Station. Didn't he break his ankle trying to show us how to take a free?
Your mother, you were saying, was such a proud Wexford woman.
She sure was.
Apart from the Bowl of Og and the 1798 influences and all like that, she was really mad into the hurling. And I think you've said that she wasn't beyond invoking divine intervention going to the matches.
No, absolutely not. The minute we got to the bridge of Charlie Ducalo's, she started the first rosary That was the first one. Now, my dad used to be mad to play hurling all the way up, and we were certainly mad to play hurling all the way to Grove Park.
Yeah.
And then we'd have to have another rosary for John and Pat Nolan somewhere along the road. She, just before Croke Park, then she went to try another one. The father said, now, hold on now. If he hasn't heard us by now, he's not going to listen to us at all.
This was trying to use too much influence.
She was going over the top. But sure, we prayed coming back as well, because it won or lost, it didn't make any difference. So,
anyway. And I think you mentioned that she liked to sing on the way home. No,
she was a great singer. She was a beautiful, beautiful singer.
Yeah.
But my father used to get her to sing.
Right.
Because he couldn't sing a word, you know, he used to have the voice like a crow. But he used to ask her to sing. And of course, she'd be glad to oblige. But like, she was just, she was a gifted lady. Like, she didn't realise how gifted she was, but she's a beautiful singer.
Right.
And she'd sing, you know, a lot of Wexford songs.
Did she have to sing The Darling Girl from Clare?
Oh, no, she wouldn't sing that. No. But she'd sing, you know, she'd sing anything. But she was just, I was, you know, talk about luck, two great parents and really, you know, did everything for us, everything. Sent us to boarding school on a guard salary. That took some doing.
It did, yeah.
But then my mother had a business on the side. She was running a knitwear business. She was actually knitting the...
She had jumpers, wasn't
yeah, she? Was, jumpers, yeah, but yeah. She had machines in the house.
Yeah.
And she used to... She got the contract. She was some gore. She got the contract for the convents in Wexford and for colleges and all sorts.
Yeah.
And she'd knit them. My father had finished them when he came back from the barracks, and then we'd pack them, and that was it. We all had a job. But that's how she got us all to secondary school.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the three of us went to De La Salle in Waterford, and I think she got a deal there because my father had some kind of relation who was, I think it might have been De La Salle brother, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But definitely she got a deal, for sure, for three.
So the... they actually bought into the hotel down here then after their guest house experience up around Boulevard.
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, when my father retired from the Guards, like obviously he had a lump sum, and my mother obviously, I don't know what she had, but they had some cash, but they bought the then old Pier Hotel in Rossiter Harbour, which was closed at the time,
right.
Which had closed for a year or so. So they bought that and they started the Pier Hotel as it was in Rossiter Harbour. And that later became the Harbour View Hotel.
I was going to say, was that different?
Yeah, they changed the name. They changed the name at that stage.
Yeah.
And then we changed the name again to Hotel Rosslare. But they started there. I think they might have bought the end of 59, but it was 1960, because I was going to De La Salle, and I was going to De La Salle, I think, that summer, that September, and it was that summer I remember working in the place with my dad and trying to get the place ready, and then I went to De La Salle. Actually, no, it was the other way around. I went to De La Salle and when I came, from Rosslare Strand, and when I came back, I was in the harbour. That's what happened.
Right. And sort of you... And I presume your brothers and other family members were involved in the helping out in the hotel.
Oh yeah.
And that started probably the start of your interest in hotelling.
Yeah, no, it was because when they bought it, like I used to, you know, I think it was the last time they bottled stout, I think, and I remember I only did it once, and it was finished then afterwards.
Yeah.
And you bottled your own stout that time, but.
With your own label and all.
Yeah. And so when we settled in there in the harbour, we were there for, my dad was there for like non-stop, and so was my mum all the time for when we got going. But they've tried to develop the hotel, but they wouldn't have had the great resources to develop it.
Yeah.
And the winter times were very, very, very poor in the harbour that time. Very, very poor.
Yeah.
So we were very brave to take it on. Like, and they were taking on a lot of hardship. So it's not a great idea in business or in life. But I believe that I started in the hotel business. I actually loved the hotel business, you know, even despite the strange hours and so forth.
Yeah.
But I did love it.
It was a people business.
A people business. And that's what I loved. And, and the stories and the people and the characters. And God, Rossiter Harbour was a great place for characters as well. Huge characters. And the fellas that were huge personalities didn't even know it themselves.
Actually, jumping forward a little bit just to when you had the Harbour View.
Yeah.
And it was practically a museum, a maritime museum, as well as being lively bar and a meeting place. And that was the place to meet the characters.
Yeah, and it was.
Yeah, lifeboat people and all those.
Like, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that was because I worked in Switzerland. And I remember lying in bed in Switzerland. And I was only a kid. And, you know, well, I was playing inter-county senior hurling before I went, but I was still a youngster. But when I was there, I remember lying in bed one night and saying, thinking, I'm going home. Whatever happens, I'm going back to Wexford. That's it. And the pull of Wexford, because of my youth and because of all of the sport and because we're so immersed in the sport and immersed in it myself, that pull of going back home. And don't forget, when I was in the Coast Guard station, I was in a bedroom, myself and my two brothers, and outside you could hear the crash of the tide every single night you went to bed, and the flash of the Tusker in the room.
Yes.
Like, you know, there's fellas paying millions for things like that, you know?
Yeah.
So
I see what you mean about it being idyllic.
Yeah. And I was watching a programme last week on Monaco. And there was fantastic mansions and so forth.
Mm.
And then they'd build another mansion in front of the front one. And I remember saying to Mary, I can tell you one thing, the place I grew up, then nobody could build that in front of us. And I had a better view than anybody in Monaco ever had.
Like,
what is richness? What is rich? What is rich? Well, that's rich.
Yeah.
And money's not rich, but that's just something special. And I remember well in 54, the World Concorde broke in two off Rosslare, and the Rosslare lifeboat going to its rescue, which was on Pate News, imagine. Oh, my God, we went to to George O'Brien Cinema here in the Strand, and we saw Pate News with Rosslare on it. Imagine that.
Immortalised afterwards in a song by Leo Carty.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, that was true. But so it was just an idyllic place to live. And, you know, and if my mother was in town, I'd go to Gal, I used to hurl against the barrack wall.
Yeah.
If I was hungry, I went to Mrs. Gal, and I got a slice of bread with some, the crust preferably, and jam on it. And that's it. And back out again and hurl against the wall.
Right.
So we lived in each other's houses. Yeah, it was just a commune, really.
Yeah.
It was just brilliant way.
Which is a far cry from today, really, unfortunately.
It is a far cry from today. Yeah. I often said we all wound up in single houses, and like if you were in the right commune, it was nearly way better, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, why you probably have answered it earlier in a way, because you said there was a connection with the De La Salle Order, perhaps. Yeah. Because I was going to ask you why you ended up in Waterford for college.
Yeah.
Rather than St. Peter's or something like that, a good council, you know?
Yeah, well, I think Val got a scholarship as well. You know, he used to do a county council scholarship that time.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And Val got that. And, well, I can tell you for sure, I didn't get that because I was too busy hurling. But Val was a studious.
Yeah,
but anyway, so maybe that was part of it as well.
Yeah.
But I had a you know, I hear a lot about the clergy, and I hear a lot of stuff that would make you cringe, and I hate the way they've managed the church and allowed it to, you know, to be mismanaged in so many ways. But I was in De La Salle for 5 years, and I'm telling you, these people give up their young lives for people like me, and they were absolutely fabulous, and I never had an issue. There was one brother who beat the crap out if you stepped out of line. Fair enough, one out of all of the whole of De La Salle brothers was okay.
Not bad.
But I know one thing, they loved us and in a proper manner, and they did so much for us. And I had a brother, Eugene, and he influenced me. He was the biggest influence on my life in sport and coaching. He played for Dublin and Cork.
Right.
And he was a magnificent. He came to De La Salle end of 58, and I was there from 60 to 65. We won 4 Munster Senior Football Championships in those 5 years I was there. And I say umpteen of our players won All-Ireland Senior Medals.
Yeah.
So when you came out of De La Salle, I was playing beside fellas that won All-Ireland medals and playing with them. And it was all football.
I was going to say, were you on the football team?
I was on two football teams.
The Harty Cup is hurling,
Harty Cup, but the Curtin and Mirra is the Munster Football Championship.
Yes.
I was beaten once in De La Salle in all my time, and that was in a Frewen Cup final, which was under 16.
Yeah.
And I was never beaten on a football team in Munster. And I played with some great players, the Gainies of Castle Island, Eamon O'Donoghue of Kerry, and Paddy O'Donoghue, they were all in De La Salle. Jerry Lucy was captain of the team I was, and we won the Munster Championship in 64. He was captain, played for Cork, played for Munster.
Mm.
You know, and we're playing against all of the great Kerry players, all of the great Cork players. Munster was fantastic competition in colleges.
Yeah.
But Brother Eugene did all that, and he was just an amazing guy. And I learned so much from him. He was doing things like plyometrics. He didn't even know what they were himself, and he doing it before you know, when he was training teams.
Yeah.
And he was brilliant, and he was a great man. He'd always find a position to get you into a game. And I learned a lot of that from him, to be fair about it. So I think I owe a lot to him for things that I learned from playing under him. You know,
that's very interesting,
you know,
because
fantastic.
That's a major influence, really.
Oh, massive.
On what became of you afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think really the man has received all that much credit in the past.
No, he hasn't. Although I've said it, but he didn't. But like, I was known as Griff. But I remember playing the Munster final against Carice Tree and Dungarvan, and they had a great team, and they were, you know, nailed on to beat us, but we beat them. But I was playing wing forward, and the wind was across the field, and the ball was coming over towards my side, but I was getting some of the high ball, but like I hadn't the power to get out. I was skinny then as I am now, practically, but I was playing senior inter-county hurling at 10 stone weight. That'll show you how skinny I was. But he said, "Call me over, Griff, listen, you go to their far side and stay wide and we'll get the ball to you." And he went around and I was through for several scores. Right. But like, I never forgot that because, you know, you'd be frustrated in there, but he was able to manage you.
There was a way around things.
A way around everything. Mm. And that's how he won so much. He did it in every position on the field. Mm. He was just, I think he was a genius.
Right.
And he showed us how to pick a ball up with a bend in your back. And he was brilliant, brilliant skill. Yeah. He played with us for a while. You couldn't get the ball off him.
Yeah.
He was just brilliant.
Yeah. And then, did you play inter-county for Wexford and after De La Salle,
before
you went to Clare?
I played for every single Wexford team, bar the senior hurling football team, before my 19th birthday.
Right.
I appeared intermediate hurlers, junior footballers, under-21 footballers,
right.
And I played minor. My first game for minor was I was 15, I was 16 that September, and were beaten by Meath and Croke Park, and the following year were beaten by Louth. I was played more football when I was young.
Mm.
And the gas thing about it was, if you were involved in hurling in Wexford at management level, they'd brand you anti-football, which
football
was an absolute...
was still quite prominent in Wexford. Wexford, of course, is traditionally a football county.
Yeah.
People don't believe that anymore. But
traditionally,
then?
In the Coast Guard station, we played 99% football.
Yeah.
And we had one of Ireland's best footballers in the Coast Guard station, and he was the missed opportunity for Wexford, but people who knew of him. A fellow called John Gallagher. And he was absolutely an amazing footballer and a great handballer. And John was emigrated at 19 or 20 years of age. But he played for Wexford, and he would have played for Wexford as one of their top players for years and years and years. Then he emigrated to America.
Right.
But and a wonderful footballer. And his brother Pat, they all played for Wexford. Like.
Mm.
And I'm the young fella, and they shoved me in the goal and pepper me with balls. Why wouldn't you get good at football? So I'd never die.
Yeah. And then when you went, of course, you did a Davy Fitzgerald in reverse.
Yeah.
You left Wexford to go to Clare.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. The hotel management in Shannon.
But I was just going to say to you about that. Loyalty was one of the reasons why I joined. I really do believe I joined at a line. My brother Pat was gone to England.
Right.
And he went back to college when he was in England. He became a teacher. Then he became a national school teacher. Then he took out coaching badges on football, swimming and all-stars. He became a professional coach.
Mm.
And then he became the Warrington Council, he became their manager for sport or whatever.
Mm.
And he was at the Olympics himself in Atlanta with a pre-Olympic team. The team before, 3 weeks before, the next group of coaches came out.
Yeah.
So he would have been kind of an auxiliary coach with that. And he always had a swimmer on the English team at that time, and British Britain team. So he was massive into sport. But from my point of view, like I was then the last to come up. And I did feel a sense of loyalty to my own parents.
Yeah.
And my dad, being a very practical, clear man, who didn't talk nearly as much as I do, or my mother did, so we could talk him into a corner anyway. But anyway, his thing was, he was talking to me about going into the hotel business after school. And he said, "You know what?" He says, "Sure, I know nothing about it, and I'm making a few bobs. If you knew something about it, you'd surely do well." So that was kind of good advice. So I went to Shannon.
Right.
And when I went down to Shannon, then that's why I went.
You went
there.
To
but Shannon, and then I went to Switzerland, and I went through the whole Shannon thing. But like, I think I did it through loyalty. And I saw in books where it's not a good idea to do that. But you know what? I never regretted it, really. I regretted losing my career as a player, but I never regretted. I never regretted going into the hotel business because I did. I did.
Between Shannon and Switzerland, your career had nearly passed you by as far as GA was concerned by the time you came back to Wexford as a player, like, or what?
Yeah, well, I did. I played for Wexford in the league afterwards, and I played.
Yeah.
But that's a bit of a tragedy attached to that. When I was in Clare, right, I played for Newmarket, and therefore I had great exposure, which I wouldn't have had. I was from Rosslare. The year I left Rosslare, I hitched actually from Shannon to play And I had been a sub on the Wexford team that won the 21 All-Ireland that year. It's the only one we ever won.
Yes.
And I was still in boarding school that time, which was a bit unheard of. I was a sub on that team. But we won the All-Ireland in 65.
65, the only time, as you said.
Yeah, only time we won it. Mm. But I was 19 that September after we'd won that. But, like... Well, it was the same month because we won it in that part. We played an intermediate Ireland final. I came on as a sub in intermediate team.
Mm.
But the point was that, like, from going to Clare and from going down there, I played on that team and that gave me the exposure. And I then played for Clare, and they tried to keep me in Clare because I was playing reasonably well for Clare. I got a goal and a couple of points against Waterford in the Championship, and I played well in the league semi-finals, and we drew three times with Kilkenny. But I was really on fire in the Waterford game, and if they'd leave me alone, I could have played a lot better because they kept insisting on me staying in the corner. And I got the scores from pulling out. But anyway, on the following Wednesday week, I was on a plane going to Switzerland, and I couldn't stay in Shannon. And my mother came down, and the boss of the hotel school said no, they were going to bring me to the old ground in Ennis to start another year of my course instead of going to Switzerland. And Clare were convinced they were going to kind of talk this man into it.
But he was a Swiss man.
Mm. So I thought, I'm not going because I'm going to be going to the old ground. But my mum didn't. Now the practicalities come into it, you know. And I know she had a private meeting with the hotel school director, who had forbidden me to play hurling anyway, by the way, because I came back with a bad injury one time and my head cut, and he was saying, that's a savage game, you know, business playing that game, what have you in the hotel business? But anyway, so what happened was that I didn't manage to stay, and I went to Switzerland the following week. I came back to Wexford, and eventually I did get on the Wexford team, but my dad tragically died with me driving, to be honest, which was a terrible... I haven't got over it yet, to be honest, if you think about it long enough, because he didn't deserve it. The third hole of his life, and he came home in a coffin, which was...
This was a road trip in Scotland.
Yeah, a road trip in Scotland, which was absolutely unbelievable, but it was just terrible.
It was a big trauma for you, wasn't it?
Oh, my God, trauma. Don't talk about trauma. I'll never forget it. But, we wound up in a place called Keswick, and we stayed in Keswick overnight. And we left Keswick late the next day, and this man in the hotel told us not to go the main road to Edinburgh. It takes forever. And take this turn off. And there's roadworks on there, but don't worry about the roadworks, just go on. You're going to be straight down onto, you'll cut 30 miles off your journey or whatever. So there was no road markings on this, and my dad spotted me going along the road. He said, that's that roadworks, turn left here. So I turned left, and then when I came out, unusually for Britain, and not unusually for Ireland probably at the time, because they were always a bit more sticklers for road safety, but there was nothing blocking you at the end of this thing, and there was no signs on it. And I came out off of this, and we got hit by a lorry. And he had come around the corner, and his lights would have been shining that way, but all of a sudden, as he turned the corner, I was just up the road from him, and next minute we're looking up at a lorry, and it hit us. But he got out of the car, and first of all, my mother was in the back, and so what happened was that the conversation started like, oh my God, everybody okay? Because we were lucky we weren't killed. And when we got out, I said, Dad, are you okay? He said, yeah, I'm fine. Look after your mother. So I just, you know, say, oh, she was fine. Now she starts worrying about the car. And I go back to the back, and my father was a great man to smoke, and he had a cigarette lit. And he said, Liam, I'm not great. And I said, oh, God. And I knew when he said that, that he was definitely not great. Serious. So my mum and myself forgot about the car fairly quickly, I can tell you then. That didn't matter. So he was actually, his seatbelt actually was a contributor, because the AA came out and did a survey with me afterwards about the accident. Do you remember the old buckles of the seats? And they were up around you everywhere.
Yeah.
And my dad insisted on wearing his coat in the car. He didn't want this heat on in the car. He hated the heat in the car. So we had no heating on the car, which was not grand. But he still had a coat on him. But when he went with the impact, it punctured his adrenal gland or something. And I don't know the details now, but that's seemingly fatal. And after a few days, it's the first time I found out about bigotry in Scotland, I can tell you, because we were checked into a hotel on the night and my dad was gone to hospital, and I went to give my mother a cup of tea, and the guy said, no, we're not doing IET. This is about 9 o'clock at night. Everything is closed except for the bar where the two guys. So Anyway, he wouldn't give us tea. And my poor old mum was distraught, like, as I was. Yes. But anyway, my mum said, ring, get the Catholic priest. That's the, because that's the only place we could go. So we got hold of this Father McCormick from Donegal.
Yeah.
And himself and your man, the hotelier, were going to box it out in the hall because he was calling him, effing him, and blinding him. And now my mother's completely traumatised, yes, which was dreadful. But anyway, he brought us to a match then. Glasgow Celtic were playing somebody. And that's the first time I saw Lou McCarrie playing. Right. And he was supposed to be great and being going to be sent to Liverpool. And I said, who's that blondie fella? It was Kenny Dalglish.
Yeah.
But anyway, we got the Celtic, my brother had come up from England. We got the Glasgow Celtic scarves. And coming back to the hospital, the priest said to us, he brought us to the match, take those scarves off and put them away.
Yes.
When you're going in there.
You were recognising yourself as Catholic. Exactly.
Which was, that was the first time we saw it. And then my father was dying in the middle of all this. So yes. went into the ward, and he was in the ward, and he had a brass band playing in his ward, absolutely. And my dad would never complain, never put anybody out. And he just says, oh God, I can't stand the music. And I went to a nurse and said, listen, my dad is very distressed with the music. She said, there's more than your dad here. And next minute they came down, I said, we think he's not well. So they came down, and I think we made a couple of journeys. Then they brought him up back into intensive care. And with that we were called, and he was dead in an hour.
Right.
So yeah. It was tough, I tell you.
Yeah.
You know, tough.
And so then it took a farewell to get over.
And that, and my two brothers as well. I felt distraught for everybody. I felt responsible, obviously. I still feel responsible to some extent, but it wasn't my fault.
No.
And I know he would have said, not your fault,
not your
know.
Fault, yeah.
But that's what happened, and it was traumatic, and there was no way for that man didn't deserve that, you know what I mean?
No.
Second holiday, I had brought him over the year before to see my brother Pat, who's in England.
Yes.
And I was playing for Wexford, actually, and we were playing Offaly and Gorey. And he said, any chance we'd do that spin again? I said, of course we will.
Yeah.
So after the match in Gorey, which was in October, I said, sure, we'll go. And we're not playing Tipperary till the following fortnight, so we'll go and we'll be back in time.
Hmm.
So I was only playing hurling for his sake now anyway, to be honest with you, because I wasn't even fit anymore. I was working in a hotel in Dublin. I was working in Intercon in Dublin and, you know, working all kinds of split shifts and everything. Yeah. It just wasn't conducive to what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
So anyway, when he died, I went to Paddy Roach, came up to the house and said, look, we're playing. And after the funeral, I said, Paddy, I'm finished, Harlan. It's over, gone.
This was Paddy, County Secretary at the
time. Yeah. So I said,
Ross Lehrman, of course.
Yeah, Ross Lehrman. So he said, we'll pick you up. I said, no, I'm not going, Paddy. I'm finished. That's it. I was only hurling for my father's sake. Because he was mad for me to stay hurling, you know. So that's what happened. But it was just an awful tragedy, and that's it. And such a trauma for my mother as well, you know.
Mm.
And having lived the life that he had lived and how hard he'd worked. And he was from a very small farm in Clare, like.
Yeah.
He used to tell my mother
she
didn't know what hardship was. 24 acres, he said, and 24, 23 and a half of them were rocks. Because how do you know that? Because they moved them all. So, that was it. So, and he was a funny character, great character. Like, he was a born publican at the end of the day. He didn't even know it himself. And he was so popular in the bar in Rosslare.
He had a good attitude.
Had a good attitude,
Just to talk about your own family then. To complete this aspect of it. How did you meet Mary and where did that happen?
Well, again, I was working Intercontinental and I used to come back down to Rosslare, home to help my mother because my father was, had died. But so what happened was when I was there, Marty O'Connor was Paddy O'Connor's sister.
Yeah,
rang me in Dublin to know would I give a girl called Mary Lambert a lift home because she'd no lift down from Dublin, would I give her a lift? So I said, yeah, well, of course, sure, go down, nobody in the car but himself. So I said, tell her to be in Intercontinental Hotel at 4 o'clock or whatever, 5 o'clock on the Friday. So anyway, there was a couple of girls in the hall as I was going out, and I was finishing the shift and I saw these girls. And I told the boys, I was one of the lads I was working with, that I was to give this girl a lift to Wexford. And Mary's a beautiful lady and a beautiful woman, but there was another girl there and she wasn't quite as beautiful as I said, I guarantee you, I picked the wrong straw again. To my surprise, it was Mary. And that's the first we ever met.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. We got, you know, so that was it.
Yeah.
So it's just fortuitous, I suppose, you know, that's the way it is.
And you had four sons.
four sons, which I think for Mary, Mary is one of two girls that didn't know anything about hurling or football. Her father wasn't, I don't know whether he's even vaguely interested, but her mother certainly wasn't.
Yeah.
So I don't think they had me or a fella like me in mind. I got there in the end, but yeah. So we have four sons. Michael's the eldest, and he's the CEO of our business now. Right. And Liam Anthony is with him in the business. He's the third.
Yes.
And then Niall is into the...
Niall,
he's amazing. Into the horses, is he? Yeah, and we were like trying to understand about why Niall was so. Mom, as I call her, but anyway. So when the kids were young, she didn't know how to manage the rackets sometimes with them, like with all hurls around the place and all footballs and all that. Yeah. But she brought Michael and Liam and Niall to Kitty Woods Riding School up in the mountain.
The Fort Mountain. Yeah.
And when she brought him, and she was driving around, and they were driving her a bit cracked. So she said, "Listen, come on, we'll bring you in here." Yeah. So she went in there, no boots, nothing. So they got kitted out. And from the moment Niall went in and got on a horse, that was it. He was absolutely, totally besotted.
Yeah.
And he was a very good rider, like, you know, and, you know, he got on very well. And Mrs. Poole was very, very nice. And
yes, she was, I know her.
She came down to me one day, and I used to have time to go to see Niall riding and some of these things up in the mountain. Yeah. So she came down and said, "You know, your young lad is a gifted horseman." I said, "I don't know, he's a gifted horseman." And she said, "You have him on a thing there. That's not so great." And she said, "I know there's a brilliant horse that he can get." And I took her word for it, and we bought this cob.
Yes.
And the famous horse was actually called Domingo.
Yes.
And Niall got that onto a European team, like to go to the European.
Match made in heaven.
Match made in heaven.
Yeah.
So from the moment he started, he was really, really, really solid. But I was listening to Michael Osborne on the television.
Yes.
Right, from
the top man in Kildare.
Yeah, the top man then for the Aga Khan, I think. Yes. Mac Toombs or somebody out in the Emirates. Like.
Mm.
And he was doing an interview about horses and so forth. And next minute he said, people that are in horses, it passes down the generations. And he said, like, it might miss one, but it'll always come back. And I said to Mary, "God almighty." Now, my uncles, my mother's brothers, they used to have, like a lot of farmers did, they had a good mare and
sell on the foals.
Yes, yeah, sell on the foals and make a bit of money on that as an aside. But they had, he used to keep telling me, and I didn't even understand the significance of it. I don't know what's the name of the horse, a very famous horse that he had one of theirs anyway, but it was lost on me.
Mm.
But he was mad into horses as well.
Mm.
And then I wasn't, neither was Pat or Val, but Niall was.
Mm.
But an interesting thing about Niall, we won a county hurling final against the Harriers, which for Rosslare was huge at the time, because I was coaching kids all the time.
Yeah.
And when we did, with the minute to go or 2 minutes to go, we were losing by a point. And Niall came over close to me to take a line ball. He was always a kind of a lovely hurler, but you know, he didn't have any great energy.
Like a daisy girl.
He mightn't do a whole lot, and then at the time he'd do okay. So I said to him, "Niall, for Christ's sake, if you ever hurl, will you hurl now? We need you." So anyway, he went out and he grabbed a high ball out of position, which he'd never leave normally, and stuck it over the bar. Draw. Then he went running around looking for the ball to be poked out, caught it, solo jumped over the bar, full time whistle, Rosslare went by a point.
And Niall is the hero.
Niall is the hero. I got the headline of the People paper. But anyway, we're going home in the car and he says to me, "Dad, do you mind if I give up hurling?" I said, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Niall, you're picking a great day to say it. We just had to win the goddamn county final." He said, "I missed an event today." I said, "You missed an event? We've won a county final. We bet the Harriers, do you understand?"
That was the event.
"Yeah, yeah. Do you understand what that means?" I said, "Dad, I'd rather be at the hurling." I said, "If that's what you want, that's okay." So I said, "I don't mind, Niall. If that's what you want to do and you have the passion for it, and I know you have the passion for it." Mm. I said, "Well, what do you want to do horses-wise?" He said, "I want to go to the Olympics."
That's an event.
And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what now. You're setting the bar fairly high." He says, "That's what I want to do."
Yeah.
And he did. And he carried the flag for Ireland.
I was just going to say to you, actually, would I be correct in saying, as a family man anyway, it's not 96... but it's your son carrying the flag at the Olympic Games for Ireland must be nearly the highlight of your sporting
life. It was an absolute massive highlight. We hired a house out in Greece and we went to watch it. But
it was incredible, like, because I was thinking about that.
Yeah, no, it was amazing.
And I would say they didn't have big parades and all that in the early Olympics.
Yeah.
I'd say it was less than 50 people have carried a flag for Ireland at the Olympics.
I'd say there is.
Between, they're yeah. twice like that, yeah. the opening and closing ceremonies.
Yeah.
But he's one of less than 50 people in 100 and something years of Olympic history.
I must say that to him tonight because he reamed me tonight. Now, I must say that to him because when he was carrying the flag, I mean, it was Athens as well.
Yeah, the original, the cradle of the games.
So, like, to me, that was huge. Mm. Now, I'm back to running here around Charlie Ducos and Ronnie Delaney in 56.
Mm.
And here is my son.
Yes.
And here's a lovely thing. Ronnie Delaney and myself become great friends.
Right.
We are great friends.
Mm.
And Ronnie Delaney has a portrait hanging in the National Gallery.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
And he gave me a copy of that, an image of it. Yeah. And he gave it to me.
Yeah.
But when I got picked for the Olympics, Ronnie Delaney drove from Dublin and brought down his Olympic tie and gave it to me for Niall, because Niall was in England today.
That was fantastic, wasn't it?
Well, and Niall still has the thanks be to God. Yeah, and I said, yeah. Don't you cherish that. But he used to stay in Hotel Rosslare because he worked for BNI.
Yeah.
And myself and myself, you sit up half the night talking about sport, any sport.
Yeah.
And he was an absolute fantastic raconteur. So we wound up doing conferences together from time to time.
Yes.
By coincidence.
Yes.
And for the first time in my life, I saw the entire race with him, and he'd never seen it, on the stage. The two were sitting on the stage.
Mm.
And I was such good friends, who said, tell me what's going through your head there. And he's telling me exactly. He talked me through the entire race. And I must be one of the few people that he talked it through.
And personal talk.
And he told me about Jumbo Elliott and about what he was supposed to do.
Yeah.
And he did exactly what Jumbo Elliott told him to do. And he came to the last bend and he was supposed to take him on because he had a kick. And the race had suited him because it hadn't gone fast enough.
Yeah.
And the man to watch was Derek Ibbotson, who was from Britain. And John Landy from Australia.
Yes.
And he coming up the straight, he said he caught them. Now, they were flat out, but he caught them and there's no chance of recovery.
No.
Because they had timed this in Villanova or whatever, I think it was Villanova. And Jumbo had done it. And Eamon Cockton, I worked with him in Borfalcha, and he actually went against Jumbo's advice and lost two Olympic games.
He fought in two of them.
Yeah, yeah. But what happened with him, what happened with him was, he told us, like, the race went too slow.
And he went
and
too slow.
He was afraid and he lost his nerve.
Mm.
And he lost his nerve at the bell.
Yeah.
And he went to the front and the race slowed further.
Yeah, he went too soon.
Went too soon. Mm. And he did the same again in the race.
Yeah.
So, like, but Ronnie Delaney, that's what he did. He gave Niall that tie and wrote me the most beautiful letter when Niall got it. You know,
that's
he was so thrilled for me that Niall should be an Olympian.
That's lovely.
And then he sent me a letter there a while ago and he said, Niall has to use these letters after his name from now on. OL something or other, Olympic something or other. And he said, I want you to tell him to use it because I want people who have been at the Olympics who are there to use it. But Niall was disappointed after the Olympic Games because he didn't get in the medals, which is great.
Yeah.
But I'm at him sitting in Athens. I must tell you about going in for the ceremony now for a minute. But going in, he just said to me, like, oh, I didn't do well. I said, Niall, for Christ's sake, you were one of 15 in Rosslare to get on a club team. You know, what would you have to be to get on a Wexford team? That's the achievement. Then you get on Ireland, only four people on going, and you were one of them. That's an amazing achievement. Daddy said, I didn't come here to make up the numbers like.
Yeah.
So we got 21st in the world.
Yeah.
And that. And he was qualified for the finals for the jump off.
Yes.
And he got picked then to go to New Zealand to play on the rest of the world team for an event that was held there over Christmas. Because he had got 21st and he was the young rider, the youngest.
Yes.
But a girl called Daisy Dick won a medal that time. And as we were sitting inside in the cafe in the Olympics, she's passing by the window. And I said, oh, there's Daisy. And she spotted Niall. She's a big baby for Niall. And she comes in, threw her arms around him with the silver medal, or the gold. I'm not sure. Yeah. Was it silver or gold or bronze? Not sure. Around it. And she said, oh, Niall, I beat you at last. He said, you picked the right event to do it. But anyway, so she had that. And I said to her, are you on the DV, Dick, by any chance? She said, yes. I said, I remember your father winning the Grand National and ESB beating Devon Locke, the Queen's horse, and
Devon Locke faltered after the last fence.
And her father was riding that horse, which is Daisy Dick. And I just got the connection with DV Dick at the time. But that's just an amazing coincidence. But it was great. But going into the Olympic Games, we hired a house in Greece about 20 miles outside of where the Olympics was for Niall. The Olympic Games were so badly organised in Greece, and Niall was in China as well for the Olympic Games, or in Hong Kong. You can say what you like about the Chinese. I never saw anything organised so well as the Chinese one. You got into a rail car, you got out into a bus, you were straight to the stadium and you were marched to your spot and it was all perfect. But it was chaos in Athens.
Was that in China or is it in Seoul?
It was in Hong Kong. The horse side of it was
the Beijing. Oh, right, yeah, they had separate.
Because there was the horse disease in China,
yeah,
which wasn't in Europe.
Yeah.
Or I think around the world, so they wouldn't allow the Olympics to be held there for horses. So they held it on the race course in Hong Kong.
Right, yeah.
So anyway, we wanted to... I was on the radio. I got a phone call from Des Cal. And he says, Des, we need you to come on. Des Cal said to me, we need you to come on the radio right away. So what the hell do you need me for now? Why? He says, we've got Niall on the other side of the phone. Oh, Jesus, I said, what's the problem? He said, hold on. Next minute, Niall comes on and he said... Liam, this is Niall. Niall has something to tell you there. And I'm thinking, oh, what the hell has gone wrong here? So Niall said, yeah, Dad, I'm carrying the flag for the man. I said, what? I said, I'm carrying the flag. And he was, as a matter of fact, as that. And I said, geez, that's fantastic, right? Anyway, so we were going out and I said, Niall, any chance we get tickets to go there? And he came back and said, no, there's no chance tickets, right? But the day before, he rings me up and he says, I can get you two tickets for €900 each. Right? Mm. He said, I'm not going to do that. And we've got all the rest of the family staying back at home. We won't do that. But with all the country about the Olympics afterwards, it's amazing that we could get two tickets afterwards for €900 each. Yeah. So I don't know if that had to do with all the carry on that was going on with the Olympics, but it was some story. But you think for parents that the guy was carrying the flag.
So you weren't actually present in the stadium?
We weren't present in the stadium. But I didn't want to leave the rest of the
I world. Understand that. But you would have expected to be looked after, really.
You would have thought you get a ticket and you could pay for it. But anyway, it didn't happen. But anyway, just about to go out with the flag, I'd come out into the stadium, when I get another phone call from Jimmy McGee, who I'd known well anyway from sport.
Yeah.
And Jimmy says, I need you to do a thing about this programme for me as Niall is walking into the stadium. I said, oh, Jesus, Jimmy. I said, no, talk me through, sure, it'll be grand. It'll be okay. Good luck. Hold on now, I'm going to do someone else the next minute. On the radio. So I'm pulled away again instead of being with the family, listening, talking to Jimmy as he's coming in, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, look, it was all great. But it was amazing for Niall to achieve that. I mean, he doesn't see it as an achievement anyway.
Because he was only 21st. Yes,
21st and it wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
But he rode in two Worlds and two Europeans and two Olympic Games with an ordinary horse, to be fair.
Yeah.
But he got the best tune out of him.
Is he running his own stable yard or something now? Or
he's in England, but he's married to an English girl who's a great event rider herself.
Mm.
They had no children for years and years and years, and they had a child a fortnight ago, or 3 weeks.
Oh, very good.
And they're over the moon. No, because all his brothers have children and he wanted to have children and she did as well. Fair. So anyway, well, he's riding away the big event in Scotland last week and he did very well at it again.
Yeah.
But we're glad he's not riding at the four-star level. Phil, it's such a dangerous sport. You have no idea. I've walked
the course. The eventing is in particular, the cross-country course,
I walked the courses with him and how he rides some of those things. They're absolutely savage. Yeah. And there's so many people killed at event and absolutely killed. They don't just survive, they're killed when they fall because they get these rotations because they're big solid things.
Yeah.
And when the horse hits it, you go flying off and he comes over after you.
They're solid timber fences. Yeah.
A good one about Niall, he was on the photograph on the I think it was Daily Telegraph, smiling in the water fence and the horse beside him and he's smiling. Right. And somebody says, give it to me. And I said, what are you smiling for? He said, first day ever, they brought in this new thing. Sterling Moss actually was part of it. It was so bad that people were dying so much on the event that they called in a crowd from motorsports and all to try and see what they could do to save their riders without spoiling the sport.
Yeah.
And they got this jacket, which they hooked to the saddle.
Mm.
So if you got fired at a saddle, it ignited it and the little things went off. They're still there.
Right.
Goes, and it was an air pocket, or air.
All right.
And held you up.
In your back protector.
Yes. But Niall got dumped off the horse going into a big water fence.
Yeah.
And the horse came in after him.
Yeah.
And landed right close to him or on him. I'm not sure. But he said, happy days or something on the photograph at the event. And I says, happy days. He said, I thank God I was still alive when I came up out of the water. Because I thought, with the horse coming in, I'd be killed. But savage, dangerous sport.
Captain David Foster.
Oh God!
He was Irish international.
He was Niall's chef to keep at the juniors.
Was he? Yeah, he
was killed.
In an accident. His widow.
Yeah.
Many years later, is now running Gordon Elliott's stable up in Mead.
Well, she's running Gordon Elliott's stable.
Sneezy
Foster.
She was brought in while Gordon was serving his suspension. Yeah. Oh, so there's just a connection. With the current.
Well, but David was actually. We knew him well. David was Niall's chef to keep, and we were at the.
He was at the height of his career now.
Yeah, he was at that time. But then also, he was a lovely man. Yeah, he was a lovely man. Lovely man, absolutely lovely. Yeah. God love him, he died a very young man.
Yeah. Well, I think, Liam, we'll call a halt for the time being just to the family aspect of your life.
Okay.
Unless you want to maybe finish up with just a few words on your parents and just how important and influential they were to you.
Yeah, well, look, at my parents were like, I wouldn't have achieved anything at anything without my parents being such good examples. And I mean, they were part of people of that had, you must remember, we really do need to remember life's lessons. My mother and father were born in the early 1900s. Mm. So they saw the First World War. Mm. They saw the War of Independence. Saw the War of Independence. That, yeah. They saw the Economic War. Mm. They saw the Second World War. Mm. When my mother was, they never had electricity in her home when she was a child. Mm. She was gone before electricity. We had electricity in Rosslare, but they had none. Mm. They were on the road between Ballycallina, you know, and down to the Courtown Road. Yeah. They were exactly well up the road. Mm. So they were very much last getting electricity. Mm. And I remember my granny and going to bed at night with a lamp and all those things in the house. So, like, we think we've got hardship today, and we think we've got lots of hardship. This saw the pandemic of 2008, of 1918 as well.
Yes,
you know, so
Spanish flu.
Spanish flu. So from my point of view, and they worked so hard, and it was for so little, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So, and all of those generations seemed to work for their families. So it's all about the next generation.
Because the 50s weren't so hot either.
No, the 50s, economically. You see, yeah, economically. Mm. But they sacrificed their own lives for the next generation.
Yes.
And like, I'm not suggesting that, you know, we shouldn't have ambitions to be better than that. But at the same time, when we say we've got so much mental health problems, we've got so much, and we have. But like, my God Almighty, you must have had some mental resilience to come through all of that. For those people,
hardship was a way of life.
Yeah. Hardship was a way of life, but they were fantastic people. Mm. I remember going to mass with my granny in a pony and trap.
Yeah,
you know, three masses of a Sunday morning. As if the church couldn't do more damage to you for Christmas morning, three matches wasn't enough. And all these pony and traps tied up outside Ballygarrett Church.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and everyone going along the roads in the black dark with the tilly
starting about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, with lights on the side of the traps and, you know, you there wrapped up in things. Like life was so tough that time. And my uncle used to go around clipping horses. We used to go around holding the torch for him, holding the lamp for him.
Right.
Well, and he used to have a machine you could turn and clip horses at night time.
But do you see...
Unbelievable, tough times.
People just got on with it, Liam.
They didn't know any better.
And they just got on with it.
They just got on. They thought that was life and that was it, and it was.
So maybe things are a bit better now.
They are a lot better now, but I think we need to appreciate it more of how lucky we are and how much we do have. Not how little we are.
You see, you'd want to have come from your background and my background to appreciate that.
Yeah, well, that's true.
There are youngsters and young people today, and I'm not complaining, I'm just stating it as a fact, who've never known that sort of hardship and wouldn't know what you're talking about, really.
Yeah, but the human will always bring everything down to the common denominator. When we crashed, we were worried about the car. When my father got sick, we couldn't care less about the car. You know, the human they'll go to the lowest common denominator to worry about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I suppose that's a bit of a lesson for life.
On that philosophical note, we'll call a halt for the moment.
Right, okay.
Don't forget to tune in next week when Phil and Liam discuss all things GAA and, of course, that little game in 1996. Keep on listening to TRP.